guardian of the universe. Simply to get the forces of evil. The powers of this man.
Hulk of the Steel Grey.
Complete tall buildings. Up in the sky.
Is it a bird?
Is it a plane?
A mailman by day.
Cities. Guardian by night.
Defending the citizens of New York.
For centuries, the world has been protected by a group of extraordinary men and women who have dedicated themselves to fighting crime. World's mightiest mortal.
He has powers far beyond the capabilities of mere Earth.
In the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's a duck.
Welcome to the Marvel Miscellaneous Rejects, the beginning of Percolated Media's look at the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe.
If you consider it, Kick-Ass, we'd be honored to have you join us.
Join Garrett.
Every duck's got his limit. And you scum have pushed me over the line.
Matt.
I'd appreciate it enormously if you could just leave us in peace until I finish this lovely pint of Guinness.
And Adam.
What I don't know is what the hell I'm doing here.
As they start their comic book movie dive by reviewing the misfits of the Marvel movies.
You don't scare me with that hocus pocus, boy.
Included in this part of the Marvel retrospective is Howard the Duck.
It's Howard, thank you.
Dr. Mordred.
I thought you'd never get back. This guy says he's on a mission from his master to kill you.
His master's dead.
Man-Thing.
I guess they didn't fill you in all the way.
The Kick-Ass films.
Just because you dress like us doesn't mean that you can be like one of us.
Big Hero 6.
Hello, I am Baymax, your personal healthcare companion.
And the Kingsman movies.
You break the law, you pay the price.
Be sure to keep checking the site, as the boys will, from time to time, come back to continue going through the entire slate of Marvel movies up until they catch up on the MCU proper.
Thanks for not giving up on me.
So sit down and open up your favorite Marvel comic, Percolated Media listeners.
And get the cover of Life Magazine, man! Life Magazine? Life Magazine went out of business, you fucking idiot!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast, Marvel Retrospective, begins now.
Are we going to stand around here all day? Or are we going to fight?
Kingsman: The Secret Service, released February 13th, 2015. Budget was about $80 to $94 million, in that range, with a box office take of a healthy $414 million, and this was directed by Matthew Vaughn.
Wow.
So Matthew Vaughn took a little break from this retrospective, but rest assured, he came back with a quote-unquote vengeance, which I don't say because, depending on who you talk to, he was booted off X-Men. I think it's a little mix of him leaving to do this and a certain somebody coming back to take control. But unlike Kick-Ass, this comic series is something that Matthew Vaughn had a hand in creating.
Yeah, didn't they kind of cheat with this? Didn't they? They waited until they actually conceived of this book, and then they were like, oh yeah, well, there's a comic I want to adapt. And I know that's a general practice that is actually done way more than people realize, but I just found that funny that Matthew Vaughn helped conceive this, and then he went to the studio like, well, there's this book that I want to do next, and that's when the studio said yes.
Now, much like Kick-Ass, I have not read this series.
Neither have I.
You know, it's Mark Millar, Dave Gibbons. The concept came from Vaughn and Millar, where, much like Marvel, Millar's universe, everything takes place in the same continuity. But they talked about how they wanted, quote-unquote, fun spy movies to come back. Because let's remember, this is 2015, so we're deep into the Daniel Craig era of James Bond. I only use that as reference because Matthew Vaughn is not only a massive Bond fan, but that was the... And still, is the when you think of spy movies, that is the Goldfinger standard, no pun intended. Although it is, we're talking about spy movies and there are puns aplenty. But they talked about how the genre had become quote-unquote too serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember reading an interview with Vaughn around this time that really perked my ears up, where, I mean, every time you mention my favorite movie of all time, I'm always going to pay attention. But he mentioned that he wants to do for this what Spielberg did for Serials when he did Raiders of the Lost Ark and kind of updated it and contemporized it for that modern audience back in 1981. So my ears were immediately perked, but I got to say, from 2011 to 2014, I was at theaters a lot. But come 2015, I was immersed in another career that I thought was going to last forever, and I did not get to movies at all. In fact, my job was movies, so by the time it was time to see a movie, I was sick of movies. So this came and went, and then I had heard some buzz about it. I heard a lot of people at the site we were working at, Matt, talking about it, and so I caved in and I watched it on, I think it might have been a streaming service, may have been Redbox, whatever, took it home, and that was the last time I'd watched this. I had not watched it since, until we did this particular podcast.
Adam, when you heard, well, let me ask you, I assume you have not read this, have you?
I've not read this. The one that I am familiar with is the one that came out later, and it's actually a sequel pretty much to these, and it's Kingsman the Red Diamond, or Kingsman and the Red Diamond, and it actually follows the movie we'll be discussing next week, so it sequelizes Golden Circle, and I enjoyed that one a decent amount. It's not written by Mark Miller, so I don't know, maybe that has something to do with it, but I've not read the initial volume one of Kingsman, no.
So let me go to you then and continue this conversation, because if you remember, when we did the Bond series, Skyfall was one of the most contentious of those reviews. And you can certainly say, regardless of whether or not you liked it or did not like it, it's quote-unquote more fun than something like Quantum of Solace. So Bond was kind of evolving and also going back to its roots, because by this time they had gotten the rights to Spectre. That was coming out later this year. But when you heard, like, we want to make a fun spy movie, did that perk your ears up at all?
It did, because I think there needed to be more in that vein. See, I'm old, and I remember being excited about watching Triple X in theaters.
Jesus.
Oh my God.
If you remember that first one, that first movie opens by basically insulting James Bond for becoming too self-serious and just erudite in its style. And that first one, I think without Triple X, I don't think you hear. But I do think there's something to be said for just having that fun, late Bond type of renaissance again. You know, I don't think we need Christopher Walken in these films, but just that kind of playfulness I think has been missing from some of these that take itself so self-serious. So yeah, I think there's a almost like a father-son enjoyment to be had by a fun spy series.
I'm not gonna comment on Triple X, because Adam, how dare you? The only thing I remember about that is how hot Asia Argento looked in it. But what I will say is, you're kind of right, because as a father, you're not going to take your son to see Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. The spy genre had really gotten down and nitty gritty, because, you know, we talked about it when we talked about Bond years ago, but Casino Royale really woke people up to the fact that Bond is a spy and the work he does is serious, and none of the movies that had been leading up to that were too serious if you go from the 80s on. So I can see the urge to do this. I can see the drive to make a more fun spy series, and so the conceit of it did interest me. I'll say that.
And even the award type stuff, you look at something like Argo, you had, and Tinker Tailor, like, that's a good call. You had some very, maybe not father-son, but grandpa-type watches. Mm. Look, I love those movies because I love film, but you're not breaking a box office with the majority of those.
No, and this is also, Garrett, you mentioned James Bond. Well, America kind of responded with our equivalent with Jason Bourne. By this time, we had had four, if you count the spinoff, but those were kind of Americanizing the spy film for more focusing on like espionage and government conspiracy to reflect what was happening in our country. And then Bond, of course, with Casino Royale would take a very similar approach. But 2015, we had this, we had Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, we had The Man from U.N.C.L.E., we had Spy with Melissa McCarthy, we had Spectre. So we got spy movies out the wazoo in 2015 of all years. This kicked it off. And Vaughn did say that it was a really tough decision to opt out of Days of Future Past because of how well First Class was received. And there's a lot of Bond influence in that, certainly. Mm-hmm. And he said, let's just make a fun spy movie. So he got together with writing partner Gene Goldman back in the director's chair. And he assembled a pretty interesting cast when you read it on paper. Because when you think of a suave, badass guy who can take down a bunch of people with no questions asked over a pint of Guinness, Mr. Darcy is not who you think of.
No. The Oscar winner from The King's Speech is not who I think of. I would have thought this would have been like a Ralph Fiennes kind of role.
Why do you say that? It's funny you say that because not only was Ralph Fiennes playing M at this point, he is the lead star in the prequel in this series.
Oh, geez. See, that's interesting because before starting this retrospective, I had seen this, but I have not seen any of the two sequels or, as you mentioned, prequel coming up. So this is my only exposure to this series is this particular film. So this next couple weeks should be interesting.
You go to The King's Speech for Firth, and I know that he was known for that. To me, he's always going to be the writer in Love, Actually. He's always going to be looking for
relief. Just, God, that's two fucking bad references in a row, Adam. God damn, you usually have one in your mind.
How dare you say that?
Oh my God, that movie's so terrible.
Well, when I read that, I said, okay, that's not who I would have imagined. But I also had nothing when it came to notions regarding the comics. So I don't know if this was casting that was close to how he's drawn on the page. Was there something there? But when I heard, because it was reported, now this turned out to be bullshit, that they wanted DiCaprio for the villain role. But Vaughn said he came as close to playing that role as I came to becoming the Pope.
Yeah, he shut that down. That was the big thing when this was out, was the casting of Samuel L. Jackson was supposed to be DiCaprio. And that was debunked relatively quick when this movie was out.
It was, but nevertheless, people believed it because that would have been, I mean, you talk about getting butts in seats, that would have been certainly an interesting road, but Sam Jackson, there is no script he will not say no to if you look at his filmography. So he's also a massive Bond fan, and this was kind of a dream come true for him in a lot of ways. And then they cast Taron Egerton, who I had no clue who he was. I knew Mark Strong because of Kick-Ass, and every movie around that time he was playing the villain between Green Lantern, Kick-Ass, Sherlock Holmes. But what sold me was the trailer. Because I knew this was coming out, but I thought it was going to be something more akin to, say, and this is going to be a pretty out there analogy, but I thought this was going to be closer to like what we were going to get with The Man from U.N.C.L.E., where it's cheeky, but it's also steeped in much more reality. And then I realized this is a comic book version of a spy movie, which I guess makes sense given the inspiration. But watching that pub scene where Colin Firth takes all those punks out and a couple of other things in the trailer, I'm like, okay, you got me curious, because even in the trailers, you could tell this is a director who has grown a lot in the 5 years since he made Kick-Ass.
Okay, I guess we'll discuss that. I don't know if I agree with that. I will say his experience on X-Men probably did influence a lot of what he does here. But as far as grown, I'm not sure. I'm seeing a lot of the same sensibilities that I saw in that 2010 film.
Well, I say grown in the sense that this looks like it was made for, and it is, it's made for a lot more money compared to Kick-Ass. This is triple the budget, a lot more action set pieces, and no disrespect to Nicolas Cage, but he's working with some pretty heavy hitters here.
That serve the same purpose that Nicolas Cage did in Kick-Ass. I see a lot of similarities.
Yeah, but when this came out, it got good reviews. And like I mentioned, people went to go see this. It made 400 plus million, which is nothing to scoff at. Nowadays, people would be like, oh, that's it?
Yeah.
But remember, original property, sort of, you know, it's a pre-existing brand, but it's not a super well-known comic. And February was a weird time. And also, as we'll talk about, this is a hard R.
Oh, yes.
More so than Kick-Ass, what was talked about was the violence. A lot of people praised it. Some people thought it was too over the top and gratuitous. And I think the most talked about thing is the big church fight, which we'll talk about. Because that garnered a lot of controversy, because of course it does, because it has to do with religion.
Seeing that first, the first impressions and the first trailer, it gave me a stylistic, you know, reminding of what we'd come to expect from Edgar Wright or those that have seen Wanted, you know, love it or hate it. But it was that kind of feel for the look and the directing style made me think of that quite a bit. So I was rightly intrigued. And I do think that Vaughn wanted to do something English and that was his way. And I think maybe he had seen the way that we talked about he wanted to bring fun back to spy movies, but also bring it back to a British sensibility. I mean, Bond is British, but in the way of movie making, kind of only by name, you know, it's very Americanized for screens. And I think this one kind of goes a different way. And it's definitely a Matthew Vaughn film. You can love it or hate it, but I appreciate that he decided he was going to make this film. And to your point, yeah, something original to make the kind of money that this did. I think maybe some of what you learn from Kick-Ass, well, we'll get into it, but I see some big differences. I see some the maturity you're talking about.
Well, Bond has been Americanized because he's now owned by Amazon, and I feel like this show should also be a funeral service for that property, because boy, do I have no confidence.
Yeah, but. And to kind of piggyback on what Adam was saying, I definitely see that, and I think that's a lot of the influence. I definitely have thoughts on the casting of Samuel L. Jackson, but I think that casting is a lot of what you talk about, whereas in America, you see the Americans as the good guys and the British as the bad guys. In this, the British are all the good guys and the American is the bad guy.
Most of them. Speaking of Bond, they wanted to do, as part of the marketing, get all the Bond actors, because they were all still alive at this point, and do a trailer where it's them talking about how we need a new generation of secret agents, and then you have Harry and Eggsy enter the room. But Connery had dementia at this time, so he was not in a good state to do it. But Craig, Brosnan, Dalton all talked about, yeah, let's do it. Which was funny because Craig was the incumbent Bond with a movie coming out that year, and he was still open to doing it. In fact, he was probably more into doing that than he was through the entirety of Spectre. And honestly, I kind of wish they did it, because that's one of the big regrets, I think, with the Bond franchise. They never did something where they got everyone back for like a curtain call. They should have done it at the 50th anniversary tribute at the Oscars.
Yeah, I think the closest they did was one of the, was that the Olympics?
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
It wasn't everybody, but it at least paid tribute. But yeah, when everybody's alive, you do what you need to do. You pay them what you can, and you just bring them there for a curtain call because they deserve it. And yeah, the Oscars photobucked that as bad as they possibly could have, especially when some of the Bonds were in the frickin' audience that night.
Yeah, and you have an Oscar winner play Bond. The OG, you had people who were still, like Roger Moore was out in the public until he passed away. But speaking of being out in the public, everyone wanted to go see this. And, well, let's talk about whether or not this, I don't want to say lived up to the hype, because there really wasn't much from a general audience standpoint.
You mentioned the date. We'll get into the movie. We don't want to keep the preamble too long. But the date is one of those where it either works or it fails. I mean, January, February, March, for the longest time, have just been dumping grounds. WB has kind of turned March around a little bit, but February has never been good. But when a movie just happens to catch a little bit of a spark, it can run and run and run. And that's kind of a big risk, because if you go in summer, you're at least going to get a pop. You'll make your budget back, and that's it, even if you suck. So big props to them to take a risk for February, because that allowed this movie to really find its legs.
Yeah, we're going to get into Ghost Rider and Daredevil, all those. Yeah, those were all released in February, so it was a risk to do this. But again, it did gather steam, and this is one of the last films I can remember that really was successful based on word of mouth. And it, like you guys said, it took it and it ran with it.
Well, this movie walked so Deadpool the year later could run, because that came out the same weekend, basically. It was Valentine's Day weekend. Hard R action movie.
And it embraced it.
But Deadpool was also much more well-known. This, unlike even Man-Thing, doesn't have the Marvel logo attached to it, but it does have three other logos to start the movie, because the freaking Matthew Vaughn's production company takes 30 goddamn seconds for all the color palettes to go away. But the movie does not open in England, which surprised me.
Sorry, real quick. Anytime this Marv logo shows up, I feel so bad for you, because it's that freaking color test. Poor Matt. It's like he's picking on you directly when we do this.
He is. I wish he would have come up with something a little less demeaning. But the cold open of this movie, it opens like a Bond movie, where it's an adventure. It's a flashback, because this takes place in 97.
Playing Money for Nothing. That's the weird thing. This movie starts off in the 90s and it's playing a mid 80s tune by Dire Straits. Right away, I'm like, dude, Vaughn, what the fuck are you doing?
And this is not a situation where they had to sell a soundtrack.
Yeah.
So I question some of the music choices. I mean, there's one later on he had to fight for, literally.
Yeah.
Because it was originally supposed to be something else. But we opened with, I was thinking of Batman v Superman, with the freaking, when Superman saves Lois in the Middle East. Because someone's getting interrogated by some company. We don't know if this is Al-Qaeda or whatever. It doesn't really matter. There's a bunch of people in the room wearing hazmat suits and basically SWAT gear. The terrorist counts to 10. One of the guys in the room jumps on the guy in the chair to stop a bomb going off, but he fails and they're both killed. And we realize that this is Harry Hart, which I kept wanting to say Harry Hole, but that's the snowman character.
That's right. It actually starts off with just a ton of missiles going off, and you're like, what the hell's going on? But then, like you said, you realize you're in the midst of an interrogation and can recognize Colin Firth from anything. So even though he's wearing the mask, you know who that is. It does get you off to a very startling start. This is a lot like you mentioned, those Bond films, whereas we have a preamble to what we're actually going to be seeing.
I think it's important right here. I think the music does it, because it puts me in a, whenever I hear this song, it puts me in an MTV headspace. I can't think of anything else but that video. But this sets the tone. This sets the look. This sets the feel. This sets your expectation for the movie. This is so hugely important because it's still fun with what it has going on. It's got the action style. And there's a lot of stuff that is dropped right here at the very beginning that doesn't pay off until later. And you kind of got to pay attention for. And this is just a great way to start. If you pay attention, this sets the tone. And tone is a big deal for whether or not you're going to enjoy this movie.
Well, they also set an expectation that I think works to the movie's advantage, in that anyone can die at any time, and that this is a spy movie. And because of that, you are spendable for any circumstance, whether you're disavowed or you're killed on duty. So I like that the movie starts off with, even though they try to save somebody, they fail.
Yeah, failure is a big thing. In the beginning here, it really does. Not only does it set the tone, Adam, as you mentioned, but it also sets up the character that we're going to be seeing go through this whole program. Failure was a part of his dad's life, and we're seeing the actual failure of that particular rescue right here. And yeah, it definitely sets the characters up. And you mentioned there's a lot of setup going on here. It's almost Back to the Future-esque, as how many things we get set up here that we are going to see pay off, but there's almost a labyrinthian feel to everything that we're going to be seeing get paid off.
Well, speaking of payoffs, I thought for sure Mark Strong was behind it, because when he takes his mask off, I'm like, all right, if this movie's about a mole or a rogue agent, it's going to be him because of that casting. But once again, I think perception helps, because he has no heel turn. And he is the, look, obviously we're going to make numerous Bond analogies, he's the Q.
That's a good comparison.
He's absolutely the Q. And he's the straight man through pretty much all of this. You got a lot of people going left, right, upside, downside, whatever, that you don't know. And Burke Strong's a really strong through line.
Nice.
Yeah, nice. And then the third person who I was shocked to see, because I thought he was left on the deck of the Flying Dutchman after Davy Jones stabbed him, because this is Norrington from the Pirates movies.
Oh.
Yes.
So Harry goes to see Lee's wife, well, now widow, and son, Eggsy, which you must hate your kid if you give them that nickname.
Well, we see this woman. It feels like she kind of does.
Well, someone in their life certainly detests him, but Harry says, look, I'm sorry. If you ever need anything, here's this medal, and you have to say, Oxford's not brogues.
Not brogues.
Now, and this is setting up one day soon. If you need a favor, do this, which I think is an interesting setup. But my question is, I always wrestle with movies when these kind of things happen out of the sake of convenience.
Yeah. Yeah. It made me think of Pulp Fiction and when Christopher Walken gets that kid in the watch. And you're right. Very convenient.
Well, speaking of convenient, then we get the title and we jump 17 years later where Lancelot. So we find out that the Kingsmen are all based on Camelot. Because you have Merlin, you have Lancelot, you have Galahad, Arthur, et cetera, et cetera. Lancelot's on a mission to rescue a professor played by Mark fucking Hamill.
Yeah. He's actually Mark Hamill in the comic, is what I read. They actually used him in the comic. And when I watched this, it made me scared to death of The Force Awakens, which was coming out 9 months later. He does not look good here. And I was just thinking, God, I hope they get him on a workout program. But it fits the character that he's playing here. And I do love the fact that Vaughn, he loves spy movies, but he's also a Star Wars fan at heart. And seeing Mark Hamill and Samuel L. Jackson in the same movie did kind of make my fanboy heart smile a bit.
I didn't even think about the Star Wars reunion. Jesus, what's wrong with me? Mm-hmm. But yet, knowing that in the comic, it is Mark Hamill, the person, I love that they actually did this. I think it's good, because if you don't know, it doesn't mean anything. And if you know, this is a brilliant Easter egg.
Yeah, that's so a good point. Yeah.
Well, I was just surprised, because this was not, he's not in the trailers, wasn't really advertised. I mean, it's a small role, but part of the surprise was because Mark Hamill was not making live action appearances. Mm-hmm. He was strictly a voice actor, but I feel like this was done in a way to be like, hey, although the funny thing, he gets more screen time here and more lines than he does in The Force Awakens.
I like him better here than I do in The Last Jedi.
Yeah, same here.
Go back and listen.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that accent's pretty faulty, but purposefully so. Like, mm-hmm. for a guy who's a phenomenal voice actor, this accent is not all that convincing.
Oh.
But to his credit, he looks better now than he did 10 years ago.
Like, that's the weird thing, right?
I mean, he's gotten himself in like really good shape for a 70-year-old man.
Yeah, and I was texting you guys as I was watching it today. I was just like, I cannot believe this movie's already 10-plus years old. And Mark Hamill looks better now than he did back in 2015.
I feel like this is though what happened when Kathleen Kennedy took over Star Wars. She put a bag over his head and said, all right, you're going to do this. And then Rian Johnson was in the room and said, you can't leave, but you're probably going to disagree with where we want to take this character. So Lancelot comes in, guns a-blazing, kills all the people, and this is where we're getting the flashy, hyperkinetic style that Matthew Vaughn has trademarked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the tooth flying out, and I love the idea of the guy getting disgusted at that. This is a real British sensibility. Guy Ritchie did this a lot. You see these fighting scenes a lot when you see Sherlock Holmes. You know, you see the same kind of action stuff. I go with it, but I'm not a huge fan of it. I'll say that much.
I think it fits for this kind of thing. I brought up some other movies before at the beginning of this, and I think it works. I don't want it in everything, and there's only a few people that I want to do this kind of stuff. And Matthew Vaughn's one of them. Edgar Wright's another one of them. I think they think it out so much that I enjoy it. It doesn't always age well. Some of the fight scenes just don't do it as well as it did 10 years ago, and because it's been copied and copied poorly. But I can still remember the first time watching this, kind of being like the first time I watched John Wick, where I'm like, oh, this is something different, and I'm really having a good time.
I feel like John Wick, though, was kind of the worst thing to happen to this movie in a lot of ways, because mm-hmm. that set a standard that I knew this couldn't reach. Because the difference between this and John Wick, there's not as many quick cuts, and they use more wide shots, because that's much more about the choreography and the gun-fu of it. Although the first one, it's pretty toned down compared to what the sequels do, which we'll talk about actually later this year.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Ballerina, ironically, he is, as he's about to rescue Professor, he is dissected in half by a woman with stilts for legs, which is another every blonde henchwoman needs some kind of gimmick. This is cool. My question is, how can she walk?
Yeah, that was my question too. On the surface, it's cool, right? It's really cool to have somebody like this extreme version of a Bond villain, right? But you're right. The more you think about it, you wrestle with the conceitment of it. But the funny part is, I read that Oscar Ponteus was originally going to be offered this role, but they didn't believe he could be a killer, which is really like the OJ story when you talk about Terminator.
Oscar Pistorius?
Yeah, yeah.
This is Sophia Batella, who was a model dancer. Like, she was one of Madonna's backup dancers. She was a child gymnast, so it can make sense.
She was not an actor yet.
No,
this was basically her breakthrough, was Street Dance 2 a couple years before this, but this kind of allowed her, pardon the pun, I'm gonna do my own Roger Moore impression, get her foot in the door making movies. So she did this, she did Star Trek, she did The Mummy.
Yeah, she was in The Mummy.
To blame this for The Mummy and Rebel Moon.
Ugh. Oh god, that's right, she was in that.
Yes. And Atomic Blonde, which is also very John Wick-esque.
Mm-hmm.
But she's the henchwoman, she's the Xenia of this movie, or insert Fiona Volpe, et cetera, et cetera. She opens the door for her boss, Richmond Valentine. I was going to say Bobby Valentine. I have the Red Sox on the mind, which is sacrilege because he's wearing a Yankees hat through most of this movie. Played by Samuel L. Jackson, and the L stands for lisp.
Because he wanted to.
But also, he said every Bond villain, a lot of them, he fought people with deformities or physical ailments, but also he had a stutter as a kid, a really bad one, and this was his kind of way to go back to that. All right, we've seen Sam Jackson be over the top before. Two words, the spirit. And it can go horribly wrong when someone does not tell him no. So how do we feel about Samuel L. Jackson in this?
I feel like he's about 30 years too old to be playing this role. That said, I like him. I think he has fun. I go along with it because I think Sammy's just enjoying being there. But the reality of this guy in this role, I'm like, it makes no sense. But when I'm watching it, I don't care. Because I don't know, something about him. The sideways basketball hat, the fact that he's, if you pay attention for the beginning, he's basically wearing Google Glass the entire film. I just like Sammy Jackson, but it's stupid as all hell.
I agree with the beginning statement that you made, that this should be about 20, 30 years younger. I think this is a really poor miscast. We see Sam Jackson, we think badass, right? We think somebody who can take control of a room. I see this character, it distracts me. His lisp distracts me. Every time he talks, I'm distracted. And I don't see Sam Jackson being a mogul who comes up with the plan in this movie. It makes no sense. Now, if you're going to do this, I would go with somebody even a little older. I would go with like a Pierce Brosnan or somebody who I can think as being calculating. I don't see Sam Jackson as being calculating. I see, well, I'll get to his plot later, but I just see this character as a total misfire. And I love Sam Jackson in almost everything I see him in. And he does go over the top. He goes over the top here and is completely distracting me from the actual character he needs to be playing.
This is one of my favorite Sam Jackson roles in a long time.
You're fucking out of your mind.
I think because he embraces the absurdity and he goes for it, because this movie, I'm going to say, if you were to ask me like what Bond actor should have starred in this movie, this feels like a Pierce Brosnan movie. Mm-hmm. Like post-GoldenEye, we talked about that one, had a really strong mix, but those movies became ridiculous. This feels like the movie he would have made after Die Another Day if he made his fifth one.
Yeah, I liked when Bond went over the top. I like when this goes over the top. I don't like Sam Jackson as the villain.
You know, because I think this plot really, you're looking like, let's say, 2005, 2006, when cell phones were really starting to take over. Because the Brosnan films were topical. Tomorrow Never Dies with the news stuff. I mean, nowadays that you can't do that now because things like news outlets are a joke. They don't have that much power, but he did a movie about the oil crisis. He did a movie, Die Another Day, that dealt with freaking North Korea, of all places. Technology and climate change. This really feels, not just with the absurdity, but the plot components, I really could have seen in a fifth Brosnan film. If you were asking me though, who I would have cast in this role if I got to get anybody, Denzel Washington. Not doing this performance, but if you were going to go the opposite, where you want him to be really like super serious, because also Sam Jackson, this is also him like making fun of Spike Lee and how he dresses with the sideways hat. And
I mean, absolutely Spike Lee. You could sit this guy to Knicks game and it would be Spike Lee.
Or St. John's for all of 2 weeks when he jumped on that bandwagon. But as we find out, Valentine is this huge tech mogul who has abhors violence and pukes at the sign of blood. Gee, I wonder if this will pay off later.
Again, another setup.
And he doesn't kill the professor, but he mentions they have something to talk about. And then we are reintroduced to Eggsy, played by Taron Egerton. Now, like I said, I didn't know who he was. Sort of like Aaron Taylor Johnson at the time he made Kick-Ass. Mm-hmm. But older, you know, he was like 25 and he's playing a teenager. But much like Aaron Taylor Johnson, he looks pretty believable as far as being like a late teen. I think the wigger outfit helps.
Yeah, he's a teenager.
He's 17 to 22. He at least looks the age.
And I'll say this, I think he's a much better actor than Aaron Taylor Johnson.
I agree. I really like him in this. I like the places this character has to go. This is not an easy character to play. This is not Kick-Ass. We keep making that comparison because that's what Americans would know Matthew Vaughn from even after X-Men First Class. I think this character is one of the most well-drawn Matthew Vaughn's ever done. I love the way he has to go from this precarious teenager getting into trouble to being the super spy that he ends up having to be, especially through the trials and things that we see him go through. I really enjoy this character. I am looking forward to seeing what they do with him in future sequels. I think he is a marvelous actor and he's a marvelous character.
I think he's great from here on out. I still think the failure to nominate, more or less win, for Rocket Man is one of the biggest slights in decades from the Academy. He deserved to win. This guy's a talent. He really, really is. I think this movie could write him a little better, but I think we spent too much time with some other characters. But he's likable right off the bat, even when he's being an ass, even when he's being precocious. And he's someone you want to follow. He has that it about him.
Yeah, I completely forgot he was in Rocket Man.
So the Academy. Yeah. You know, this was the first thing I had seen him in. And like I said, he's age appropriate. I think he's got screen presence. And this character is a hard one to play because you can't make him too punkish. You can't make him too whiny because you have to be on his side throughout the whole movie. I think they accomplished that. Like, there's never a part where I'm not on his side, even when he's on the outs.
When you're selling it to an audience outside of England, he's got to be somebody that worldly you can get on board with. So he has to have that Bond factor. that he has the coolness while still being Brit.
Yeah, because before we even see him, I mean, I'm thinking we're going to be following Colin Firth throughout this entire film. I have no idea what this comic was, what the story was. So you're right. Once we're introduced to him, we need to be on his side. And I think Vaughn does a really good job of outlining exactly what he has to go through.
Well, they also do a very, what I would call typical thing, where he's got a disastrous home life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very abusive stepfather. And he fits a lot of like the tropes of these types of characters where rebellious teenager, petty criminal, but they mention that he has, you know, later on we find out that he dropped out of the Royal Marines.
Mm-hmm.
He was a gymnast. So what I like also is you see him do this stuff so that when Colin Firth mentions it later on, when they're at the pub, you're like, oh, that tracks. Because we'll see in a little bit, he like evades this entire group of people doing parkour. And I'm like, okay, no typical street kid. He's not Aladdin. We'll cross that carpet in a couple of minutes. He's wearing the medal, wearing the medal as a necklace. And he goes out, and I have to say, this movie kind of reminded me of a Guy Ritchie film because some of the accents are so thick, I can't tell what they're saying.
Yeah, I had the subtitles on.
Yeah.
Like, and it's so like watching Brad Pitt in Snatch, where I'm like, can someone put peanut butter in his mouth so he can talk?
And some of the phrases, some of the colloquialisms that they use, if you don't know what they are, you just have to kind of like nod your head and go along with it.
I'm like, all right, I guess he insulted him because everyone looks really offended because he has to do a confrontation with a bunch of Flash Thompson and company. And we also see one of the things I think this movie does really well is showing you before telling you, as I alluded to earlier, because we see here the sleight of hand because he takes the kid's car keys, which plays a big role in one of the reveals later on and something he tries to do later on. So you're seeing, you know, in a lot of ways, he's kind of the superhero archetype of like a Robin.
Definitely. And it's also, it's so ironic that he is going through this big training that he's going to be going through, and this huge super plot is going on at the exact same time, which is a conceit you got to do with these movies. Bond did it all the fucking time. I'm not criticizing the film for that, but it's just something you kind of have to go with that. Yes, Samuel L. Jackson is doing all of this while this kid's being trained, and it's all going to come together at the end. You just go with it.
We're also introduced to the rest of the Kingsmen. So Arthur is played by Michael Caine, because much like Sam Jackson, there was a period where there was a film he would not say no to.
I forgot Caine was in this.
Well, it's a smallish role. You know, it's a glorified cameo in a lot of ways. He's got a couple scenes, but...
Well, it's a big role, though.
Yeah. He's M.
If he went bad.
Yeah. Which they've teased in a lot of Bond movies, because mm-hmm. you thought Lyons was going to turn out to be the villain. But they're talking about how they need to find a replacement for Lancelot, so every Kingsman has to submit a candidate. Which, really, the first part of this movie, it's the UK version of Men in Black. Like the test that they do,
uh-huh.
the older Tommy Lee Jones and Colin Firth being the veterans, and then the young upstart kid, because remember, that came out at a time where Will Smith was a young man,
mm-hmm.
and his vernacular didn't make him sound old and outdated. And, you know, it's a similar dynamic. Their partnership, and they quote-unquote lose their mentors, although both sequels undo that. Because Men in Black 2, they bring Tommy Lee Jones back, and then we'll talk about how they bring Colin Firth back in the second one.
Oh, spoiler alert.
That's right, you haven't seen the sequel.
No.
And bye.
Well, two words, twin brother.
Oh, shit.
Or do they? I'm not going to tell you how.
Okay.
But Eggsy steals the car, gets arrested, and he tries to make his one phone call. So this is where I'm like, okay, I could see why, but you didn't have someone else you could call given your connections with not just your friends, but you were in the military.
This meet cute is about the only time that I'm not on board with it. Because you can't tell me that this precocious little pain in the ass, if he knew that he had some type of favor owed to him on this coin, he wouldn't have called this in when he was 12, 14, 16, especially when him and his mom are living in the slums. It is the most setup that's not used well. And I'm sure he's been arrested before.
No. Yeah, I'm sure he's been in and out of county jail for vandalism and misdemeanors and things like that. He does make the phone call, and he is reached out to by Harry because he meets him outside the doorstep of the jail.
This is after the car chase, right?
Yeah, where they steal the car.
Where they steal the car. I like that chase. I like when he's driving backwards. I thought that was a really well-conceived scene. And I gave Vaughn a little bit of a hard time with the action on Kick-Ass, but I think this is improved on that. And as you mentioned, Matt, that he had done First Class in between. So I feel this is Vaughn reinforcing those action tropes with a better sleight of hand than he did in the movie 5 years before.
So he takes him out to the pub and he sort of cross-examines him, where he mentions his background, talks about his relationship with his dad, before they're rudely interrupted by the bullies from earlier. They basically say, "Hey, old man, get out of the way." And I don't blame them, because the one thing Colin Firth is, I wouldn't expect him to be, is a umbrella-wielding badass.
Yes, this is great.
But the minute he goes to that door and locks it, I was thinking when you first saw Liam Neeson do Taken, where it's like, oh, now it's a joke, because Liam Neeson made that movie 50 times. But back then, it was surprising. This is great, where he flicks the glass into the guy's head. He's doing the Batman thing, where I'm going to cripple some people in all likelihood. I'm not going to kill them. Because we find, much like Bond, he's got gadgets. The umbrella has like a stun gun in it. It's a shield. So I like a lot of the tech that they incorporate to make this feel Bond-esque.
Very Bond.
You did very Bond. I said very fun. it's light. It's enjoyable. The only downside to this scene is I can't stand the people they're fighting. And it's not only that I don't like them, I can't stand watching these people on screen. Something about it. It is choreographed within an inch of its life, and it's a freaking delight to watch.
And he gives them the same pitch that Tommy Lee Jones gave Will Smith, where if you want to make a difference, follow me to this unassuming place that turns out to hold a private intelligence group, except instead of fighting aliens, we find out that the Kingsmen... Now, I thought this was smart, because my question's like, okay, how did they get all this money? They talk about how when they lost all their heirs during World War I, they decided to pool their resources and go towards protecting the world, because this came out back in 1920, everyone got along.
This is when it really pays to pay attention and realize just how much of a class movie Vaughn is making here. I mean, this is really an attack on just the aristocratic class in Britain, and it is very well done.
And also politicians in general.
Yeah, politicians and...
Elon Musk.
Oh, God, yeah.
When he was, you know, winning awards for his environmentalism and LGBT rights.
In fact, there's a Tesla in this movie.
So he takes him to a tailor shop, which turns out to house their secret facility. And this is where he meets all the other candidates. So there's the archetypes. There's the rival, who's kind of a stuck-up prick. There's the girl, because we need one. And Merlin says, I love this with the body bags, where it's like, write your name on it. Because not only can you die here, but if you ever say anything, for all intents and purposes, we will hunt you down and kill you and your family.
We'll put you and your family in that bag. This movie, more than any I can remember, really gives you anxiety. It has a real... I mentioned this when I talked about Kick-Ass, and that Vaughn has a really dark heart, and it is on full display in this movie. There are parts of this movie that will give you anxiety if you have any kind of heart whatsoever. There is some rough stuff in this movie. We'll get to the scenes when we get to them, but my God, if you thought Kick-Ass had it, it did, but he goes full on with this one.
It's not interested in pulling its punches. It's almost uncuffed that way. It's like, I'm just going to do what I want to do. And they sure as hell run that way.
I also like that just because they're quote-unquote kids doesn't mean that there's going to be any training wheels.
Oh, yeah.
Harry is doing some investigating with Merlin, where they realize that the professor was kidnapped, maybe tied to the Valentine character, the Sam Jackson character, but he showed up to his office the next day, clear as day, like nothing happened. So Harry goes to interrogate him, but before he can get an answer out of him, they pull his scanners and just blow his head off. It's like the Suicide Squad, where they put bombs in people's necks. Mm-hmm. Now, this took me by surprise. Not just the fact that they offed him. It's how they did it. I mean, look, I knew this was R, but I mean, there's some stuff in this that genuinely surprised me with the amount of blood that there was.
Yeah. And the first time you watch it, it is just surprise after surprise after surprise.
Yes. And I will say, what I also like is that on repeat viewings, I don't feel like it's a redundant experience, because you can pick up little tells with some of the character dynamics as it goes on. Not necessarily this, but even the way Michael Caine talks to certain people and certain lines he has. No, because he openly says, like, I don't think this punk is good enough. Like, when he brings them in. Because, you know, everyone else is wearing a suit and went to, like, Oxford or Cambridge. He's just a, you know, a street rat.
Yeah, he's not wearing the tweed yet.
No. And this also does the thing of putting Harry in a coma, which I thought this was how they were going to write him out of the movie, period. Like, I thought this was they were going to kill him off and, you know, he comes back at the very end. But... he's in a coma long enough to grow a beard.
I did like that that's how they do the passage of time. Because you don't know how long it is other than Colin Firth grew a beard.
Because you're wondering, this training has to be pretty extensive. But I also like the thing of, we're only going to pick one of you. It adds to the urgency. where it's like, okay, you really have to beat your competition.
But at the same time, we get to the first trial, but they're encouraging teamwork as well. So they're really throwing these kids off with how they're training them here.
Yeah, I mean, there's no better way to put the fear of God in somebody than to flood the room, which is what they do while they're all sleeping.
Oh my God, this fucking scene. Again, anxiety up the wazoo with this fucking scene.
Yeah, because they come up with the improvisation to use the shower heads as air, which is anatomically possible. I mean, look, this is more realistic than Bond driving an invisible car. Well, at least at the time. Now that seems very doable.
That part is getting the shower head to get under the U in the toilet. That absolutely works. Other than that, I can't stand underwater scenes in most movies for the rest of this, because there seems to be no limit on the amount you can move around before you run out of air. Everybody else is sucking on toilet air, but Eggsy's swimming around like without a care in the world. If you have ever tried to punch or kick or move underwater,
you can't.
You can't.
No, it's impossible.
There's a famous diving movie. There's somebody scared of diving into the water, and somebody pulls out a bucket of water and fires a gun into it. And the bullet slows down so much, it doesn't dent the bottom. You can't punch glass. I'm enjoying the scene when it goes, but I've seen this movie probably half a dozen times. And at this point, I'm just like, God, I hate this type of shit. But when you watch it, it's exciting, it's thrilling, and you don't know at the end of this, I can't believe what they pull.
But Matt hit it, because this movie is hyper-reality, and you're not going to drive an invisible car in 2002. You're not going to be able to punch glass underwater at any time. So I'm going with it just because of the hyper-reality concept that they're going with. But you're right. If you think about it too much, as I mentioned with the henchwoman earlier, Gazelle, then your fucking head's going to spin, because your head will explode. Yeah. If you get too caught up in the reality concept, then you're not flowing with the film. And I'm flowing with the film here. I see that he is the odd man out who will go to the glass and punch it. I like the shots that they do here, where first is sitting there watching it. As soon as he approaches the glass, he walks away knowing exactly what he's going to do. Or that's actually Mark Strong there. I thought that was nicely done.
Also, like, he would recognize it's a see-through mirror, because he's been in those interrogation rooms so many times that he would recognize. Also, extra points for him having a shirt off, because that is a very handsome man. And
he was very proud of that, too. He was out in the fucking press saying how proud he was, how good shape he was. And the fact that they photographed him like this means it'll live on in infamy. Fucking narcissistic bastard.
You can tell that he did the work, because you got one other person that kinda has a shirt off, and then everybody else is covered up. So good for him, and please be Wolverine one day.
No, I think it could be Bond, actually.
I do, too.
Now, I don't think they do it because of this, but with Amazon running it, nothing would surprise me. He'd be a better Cyclops than Wolverine. He'd be the perfect Cyclops, because he would actually command respect, which James Marsden is incapable of doing. But speaking of commanding respect, they get praise for using teamwork and intuition, but he says, "You all failed because one of them died." And the camera cuts, and he's lying on the ground dead.
Yeah, good reveal. Yeah,
that other girl, which, this always bugged me, because I don't feel like it took it serious enough, and I always felt like this was staged. No, she's really dead.
Yeah, they could have staged it, because there is some theatricality with some of the tests where it turns out to be just that. But I like that this, you're down one less person, but there is that empathetic aspect of, oh, we kind of let somebody die. So we cut to, I mean, there's a lot of scenes where they just cut to Valentine talking to, this guy's like the prime minister and the princess of Sweden, trying to get them on his side. And he's giving them the spiel that humanity is going to blow itself up, and basically, it's a mix of climate change and a new master race, where it's like, we're going to repopulate the Earth, where I will pick only the best and the brightest or the dirtiest to lead us.
Good villains have plots that you kind of agree with, and I kind of agree with his plot. Humanity is going to destroy the world, so I'm going to destroy humanity to preserve it. That is something that people, certain politicians, have been screaming about for decades. And I like the fact that even though I don't like Samuel L. Jackson in this role, I like the main villain's plot.
Yeah, I mean, shit, Thanos was right. So, yeah, Sam Jackson's on something here.
The princess doesn't agree, so she gets taken away and is kidnapped, which they also mentioned that there's a lot of world leaders and celebrities who've been kidnapped.
Yeah.
Never seen again.
And they were going to go with a whole bunch of celebrities here, too. Like, I heard Lady Gaga's name thrown around. They do one that we see later, but it was going to be much bigger. But Vaughn was like, you know what? That distracts too much from the plot. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, and he's also like, I don't have $300 million.
Exactly.
I don't even have $100 million. I got to put the stuff on screen because we got a third act to film.
Yeah. How much was it? About 90 mil, you said?
Between 80 and 94.
Okay. Yeah. So I would say that's 94 plus. So he might have cracked 100 with this, but he didn't have as much to work with as, say, Bryan Singer did on Days of Future Past. So you had to kind of go with what they were giving you.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is considerably more than he got for Kick-Ass, but I feel like First Class cost a little bit more, I would think.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because that was made for between 140 and 160. So I feel like Vaughn's at his best in this middle ground type of budget.
I agree.
Because I think First Class, one of my knocks on it is some of the renderings are pretty bad and some of the CG with the action isn't incorporated all that well. Not entirely his fault, but I also don't think he has the wherewithal to fully recognize that because he's never... It was not James Cameron. He could spot a coffee stain on someone's shirt because he's so freaking analytical. But the recruits are also told the next day, you have to pick a puppy to raise. Eggsy picks a pug, another Men in Black reference, because there's Frank, but he thinks it's a bulldog, which I find hysterical.
I also like, too, that he's criticizing Roxy, you know, Poodle, and she smartly, you know, was just like, Poodle's a multi-generational hunting dog. You know, everybody's got their own reasons. It's great. But he's the underdog, and he literally picks the underdog. Mm-hmm. And come on, that pug is cute as all hell. I can't stand little dogs, but dang, JB is cute.
Yeah, well, thank God there's no Chihuahua. Otherwise, I'd dropkick that goddamn thing.
I love little dogs. I've had Dachshunds the majority of my life. And I've had friends who've had pugs like this. You're right, Adam. It's an adorable dog.
Bigger, right? And I'm like, yeah, the pugs can get decent size, but not enough to be like a hunting dog.
Yeah.
I mean, not that it matters, because he literally, we see him trying to drag the dog, but instead he just picks him up and carries him like a baby.
I love that.
There's one thing about pugs, they can be pretty stubborn.
Yep.
And she's also smart by picking the poodle, because if you notice, some of those dogs are much easier to train, because you see a golden retriever. Mm-hmm. I think there's a German shepherd, and those are some of the smartest dogs you can get.
Yep.
I like every test has some kind of hidden strategy to it. He wakes up from his coma, and I was thinking of South Park where they take Cartman's fake beard off, but no, he actually shaves it, so it's real. And they find out that Valentine is giving a Steve Jobs-esque interview where he announces he's going to give SIM cards to everybody that offer free internet access, free cell phone coverage. All you got to do is go and pick one up. I love how everyone is like, oh yes, I see no malicious intent in this whatsoever because it's free. People are sheep.
Very Jim Carrey-esque from Batman Forever.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a box in every home.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But again, I don't see Sam Jackson as Steve Jobs, so it doesn't do anything for me when I see this.
Well, I also love how he's wearing a pink shirt on top of a pink shirt. Must be a Bret Hart fan.
Oh, shit.
You see, if Spike Lee had a child with Mark Zuckerberg, this is who it would grow up to be.
That's an image I don't want to think about.
No, I don't either. But you know what? I think Jesse Eisenberg would have worked in this as well. Maybe. Oh, like,
that's so on the nose at that point.
That's true. Thank God they didn't go with Eisenberg with Lex Luthor. Oh, wait, they already did that.
Harry realizes he needs to arrange a meeting with Valentine. So this is playing into the Bond trope of we need to have Bond meet the villain face to face. But the difference is, I also love they literally Americanize it by them eating McDonald's.
Yes.
Like going to the White House. Oh, God.
Well, I love how the first time you see Valentine talking to somebody, it's clearly in the Oval Office. And then they cut to outside, it's the White House.
And I heard in foreign countries, this is Hardee's and not McDonald's. Yeah.
I mean, what works for me in it is it is self-aware of everything that it's doing. So it's able to play and have fun in that realm. There's other movies that think they're smart enough by acknowledging it, but this one, it's fully on Front Street.
And another thing it does that's really clever too is at one point Harry's talking to Eggsy and he's mentioning all these movies, right? Like, haven't you seen Trading Places? Haven't you seen this? Haven't you seen that? And then all of a sudden Eggsy comes out with My Fair Lady and he's just taken aback, like, wow, you are more cultured than I thought you were. And the movie's doing that too. So when you see this, they're not going to a fancy restaurant, they're eating fucking McDonald's or Hardee's or whatever the hell they're doing in what country you're watching this in. It's very cleverly done, and it does it in a way that, unlike Deadpool the next year, it doesn't talk down to the audience. It actually recognizes what it's doing.
Well, they're also openly talking about, do you like spy movies?
Yeah.
And the old ones were better. And, I mean, this movie is very self-aware, but they don't go as far as to literally wink at the camera.
Exactly.
So I think it's a good representation of being a spy film, but it also works as, I don't want to call it a spoof, that's Austin Powers.
No, that is what it is, though. It is a parody of those films, if you watch it. I mean, how extreme it goes later, this is a total parody of those films. I think you're right on the nose with that.
Part of it is parody, but I think it deconstructs it a little more, just because I think there's some thought into it. It parodies certain parts, but I think it's almost deconstructive in the way that Kick-Ass was for superhero films.
Yeah, although I will say I think this one has a lot more fun with playing with the spy genre, and it works more as a deconstruction than either Kick-Ass film did as a critique or breakdown of superheroes.
Well, this is doing for spy movies what Kick-Ass did for superhero films, right?
Yeah, I'd say to a point. So they endure more tests, including they pull a scene. Mission Impossible would do this a couple years later where they jump out of the plane to land in the target zone. So they're quelling the herd. And I also love the test where they all have to seduce the same person, and it's a blonde woman included. But it goes wrong because they get tied to train tracks, which I also love that because that is James Bond being tied down with the laser coming towards them.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Also going back to those old silent films, right? Where people are tied to tracks and they have nowhere to go. It's playing off that as well.
But as we find out, Harry, well, Eggsy doesn't rat him out earlier in the movie when his stepfather beats the shit out of him. And he doesn't rat him out here. So he passes, Roxy passes, and the other guy fails because he chokes under pressure.
Yep. I think it's important too. Like, we never know who nominated who other than Harry with Eggsy. But we find out here who nominated, can't even think of the name. I keep thinking of him as freaking
Charlie.
Yeah, British Harry Osborne, basically. I mean, let's be honest, this kid's from Green Goblin. But that it's Michael Caine who nominated him by saying, I'm so disappointed in you. It kind of foreshadows where this goes towards the end of it. His choices and the kind of person he would pick.
Yeah, this is one of those things that on first viewing, you just think of it as next to nothing. And then you realize, oh, this has much deeper meaning. They have to do their final test where they sit with Michael Caine and he tells them to shoot the dog. Now, you could hear people in the theater gasp, and it was dead silence in that theater. A full minute.
Yeah, this... Look, I mentioned when we did Kick-Ass 2 that the absence of Vaughn is what made that movie really suffer. And I thought he was the unheralded hero of that franchise in that his absence is what killed it. I have done a 180 with this movie because this scene was being encouraged by Vaughn to have them actually kill the dog because it was an old Nazi test. You can't have empathy with anything. You have to do what you have to do to pass the test and to go on with your mission. It was Jane Goldman who came out and said, no, you can't do that because if you do that, the audience will not be with your main hero. And my God, she is exactly right. This was the right impulse. I like the write out of it actually being blanks. And again, this movie's corrupted heart is right on full display here because fucking A, man, you're looking at the close up of the gun. You're looking at those cute dog eyes look right at the gun. This is tough, guys. This is really, really tough. But yeah, I like the write out they do.
Those big Amanda Seyfried eyes.
I didn't make that comparison.
Or Anya Taylor-Joy, take your pick.
Oh, shit.
I like Eggsy's response to it in the end, that he's just willing to turn his gun on him instead of the dog. I'm just like, that's my kind of boy right there.
Well, I also think Jane Goldman saw John Wick a couple months before this and said, let's not shoot a dog.
That's true, too. I didn't think about that. But yeah, Wick would have come out a couple months before this.
Harry kind of chastises him for not shooting the dog, and they cut to a stuffed taxidermy dog.
Yes.
Which leads you to believe that he actually pulled the trigger. And he says, no, I cared for the dog. He died of pancreatitis, and I didn't shoot the dog. And we find out they're blanks. But by doing so, Roxy won the job interview. There's no prize for second place.
And again, you think she actually kills the dog because you hear the gunshot go off. And and then Michael Caine goes, at least she has balls. And I'm like, oh, my God, did they actually kill? Nope, they're just blanks.
So from here, Eggsy's not part of the Kingsmen, but he has one last talk with Harry before they depart because Harry has to go to a church that Valentine has backed that is, as we find out, filled with nothing but white supremacists and basically the Republicans for all intents and purposes.
It's the Westboro Baptist Church, right?
It's the people from A Time to Kill.
Yeah.
Speaking of Samuel L. Jackson.
Yes.
You know, it's Kiefer Sutherland. It's who's the guy, Boddicker from RoboCop?
Kurtwood Smith.
I think he's in there. Like, it's just the scum of the earth that if someone went to quell the herd, I don't think anyone would complain. But they also use this to show Valentine's Endgame, where the implants, if they don't make your head explode, which is a failsafe, they shut off your inhibitors for aggression. So you basically become the zombies from 28 Days Later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought of Rage as well. Yep. Especially when we get the mom going after the kid later. That's exactly what I thought of, Matt.
Or World War Z.
Yeah. Yes,
except 28 Days Later is a good movie. I fucking hate World War Z so much.
I do too.
But because Harry is exposed to it, so he just murders everybody.
Set to
Leonard Skinner's Freebird.
Yeah, Freebird, which, let's be fair, 2 years before this, Rob Zombie had already played this card. Actually, a few years before that. It was actually 10 years before that. He played this card when he did Devil's Rejects. It was the same thing. You see a set of murders happen to Freebird. It originally was supposed to be November Rain, but Matthew Vaughn said that the guitar solo wasn't long enough. So he just Googled longest guitar solo and came up with Freebird. So he injected it here. Guys, this is another one, man. Tough fucking scene. And Vaughn apparently wanted it 7 minutes. And Millar, of all people, was like, fuck no, that's too extreme. It's really tough to watch this scene.
Yeah, he basically did in The Rocketeer where Paul Sorvino is like, I may be a criminal, but I'm not a Nazi.
Yeah.
This kind of sold the movie. This was the standout scene, and by God, it's glorious excess. This feels very Tarantino-esque.
Very Tarantino-esque. In fact,
I was thinking of that fight scene in the first Kill Bill.
Yeah, I thought of Kill Bill, for sure. This scene, when I originally posted that I was watching this way back when I rented it, everybody underneath that thread was like, wait till the church scene, wait till the church scene, wait till the church scene. And it is. It's deliciously brutal. Although, even though they trimmed it, it could have been trimmed a little bit more, but I guess not. If you're going for exactly what Vaughn's going for with this plot.
This thing is so glorious. The only thing that would make it better for me is if it said Westboro Baptist on the outside of this church.
That's exactly what they're going for here.
Oh, no, I know that's what they're doing. He also doesn't want to be sued.
Yeah, exactly. Directly. Yeah.
But I love that that's what it is. And this thing is amazing. Not just because, yes, it's hyper-violent, so you have to do that. The way that it's cut and the way that the camera moves to the music, this thing is a dance. It's choreographed like this rest of this movie to within an inch of its life, but this thing moves like a dance through the song, and it's just so fantastically done in an obviously horrifically brutal way, but it is what this movie is. It is what his style is, and it's just glorious. If you show anybody this movie, you show them this scene, and the only thing that's better is when you think that this is, as far as the movie goes, the ramifications of it to Harry after.
Yeah, I like that there's a couple of minutes where what he just did, he has to live with. And let's also remember, everyone like Eggsy and Merlin watched the footage. So they're all like, what the fuck just happened? Because he didn't buy a SIM card. But as he walks outside, the most surprising thing in the movie, he is shot and killed. There is no gray area about it in this movie. He is shot in the head, and we never see him again.
Well, according to you guys, we do see him again, but we don't see him the rest of this movie. This was, again, shocking to me. I was not expecting him to leave this film. Maybe that's a trope. I don't know. I don't remember the head getting killed in any of these other films that I've watched. But this took me by surprise. I was expecting to see Colin Firth throughout the entire film.
Completely took me by surprise. I think that's why this works. This ain't that kind of movie. And then immediately it buys back that he can't stand blood by throwing up after he did what he does.
Yep, paying that off.
They pay it off twice.
Well, yeah, we'll see it again later.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is also the same beat and placement as killing off Nick Cage in Kick-Ass.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought of, Matt, was the
I guess you're right.
Yeah, the Nick Cage murder in Kick-Ass is definitely what I thought of.
I appreciate that it doesn't dwell. It doesn't hesitate. There's no, oh, Mr. Bond, I'm going to torture you now. That it doesn't do that. This is, if Godric had just pulled out a gun and killed him instead of fucking around with the laser, he would have got away with it.
Well, he even says in those old movies where I tell you my secret plan and then let you get away, this ain't that kind of movie. And I also like that he doesn't kill him with the head explosion. He just nonchalantly shoots him. So yeah, genuine surprise. Didn't see this coming. And I'm always impressed by movies that can be unpredictable. And I feel like this movie does a good job with that, because the next scene is Eggsy coming back to Kingsman, and he notices Michael Caine's character has the scar that Mark Hamill had. So he realizes that he's in on it, and he basically says, yeah, his plan makes a lot of sense. And if you don't go along with it, I'm going to blow your head off.
Yep.
Because Michael Caine does not, especially at this time, he did not play villains.
No, he did not. This like, is another thing.
He was Alfred through and through. Although some people would call Alfred a villain because he didn't get Bruce Wayne the mental help he so desperately needed.
Which we've already discussed. Another thing I was not seeing coming as the payoff of this, again, is he makes this drink and it gets switched in a sleight of hand, as you mentioned earlier, Matt. This is another scene, very well pulled off.
Yeah, it's also Vaughn's going after elitism.
Yep.
The little things us middle-class people can do that you guys don't see, because we've seen him do sleight of hand before, because we also saw earlier on he tries to steal the car key that's the grenade in the big room. He's like, nope, put it back. But he gets him here, he just electrocutes him and dies, because they're saving all the head explosions for the last part of this movie. And I was also expecting Merlin to be in on it, because it's Mark Strong, but thankfully that they don't do that, because he's I guess, leading Kingsman now by default, if you're going like seniority.
Yeah, by default, exactly.
He says, all right, we got to figure something out, because he takes the chip out of his neck and they have to go to Valentine's secret bunker, which is basically Gustav Graves and Die Another Day with the Ice Palace.
For sure.
Yeah. Classic Bond villain lair.
Yep, because all the conspirators are there. So
I love the design of this lair.
Yes. Well, I mean, this evokes the volcano lair. Yeah. This is really paying tribute to Bond in a good way. And they hatch a plan where Eggsy's going to pose as Michael Caine's character. I guess they don't have Face ID on these phones. That's the one. They send Roxy up to the atmosphere to take out a satellite. I'm like, gee, that one sounds a lot harder than just sneaking in.
This is playing off this is playing off this character's fear of heights, which we established earlier. This whole thing could have been cut, guys. This has zero payoff when she eventually does do it. I did not like this at all. This is one thing in this movie that I would say, just cut it out.
My thought was, why don't you just send both of them into the bunker?
Yeah.
You couldn't break up the satellite network in the lair?
Exactly.
It also takes fucking forever. If you're stressing the urgency, you know you're on a clock. It's going to take her an hour just to get up to the friggin' atmosphere.
Yeah.
At the rate she was moving.
At the quickest, yeah.
But I love it. They're like, all right, see ya. Good luck. Try not to die. And he sneaks in, dressed to the nines. So also, I feel like they gave her the more dangerous one because she technically won. He's not a Kingsman.
Yeah, that was the other weird thing, was he didn't pass. So why did they give her the most difficult thing?
Well, and Merlin's like, well, you're here, so I guess you can help. But he gets...
very lazily done. I'll say, in a movie that's, for the most part, been pretty well written, this felt very, very lazy. This whole thing that you're explaining, Matt. We'll talk about the conclusion. We'll talk about the fights and everything at the end. But the way it's conceived, the way it's put together, is not very good.
I just feel like it could have been more streamlined.
Yeah, but a little just too much going on. The back and forth is unnecessary.
But he manages to break into the party, knocks out the prime minister we saw earlier on. But Charlie is there because his family's rich, so it makes sense he'd be there. And he tries to sell him out to Valentine, but Merlin's able to activate the failsafe. And I thought Macho Man Randy Savage was going to have to go. Because I can't not hear that music and not think of that.
Exactly. And even before that, I don't think it's a coincidence that these troops are dressed in white, because they kind of have stormtrooper shooting syndrome where they can't aim for shit. He's right in front of them and they can't even hit him. And then when this is paid off, yeah, very, very parody, right? This is total parody where everybody's heads are exploding like this. And it's not exactly blood, it's goop. It's all really weird, but funny. I laughed.
I love this so much. It is so far over of all the things that were hyper violent in this, that it decides to poke fun at it this way is such a great decision. And this is just, I love
it. Also not, the explosions are not like raining blood from the sky. They're like fireworks if you put food coloring in there.
Yep.
Yeah, it's like a big confetti balloon popping.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and even when it's done, it's not covered in viscera. It's enjoyable.
And that's,
as
and that's,
sick as that is.
Yeah, and it's done because Valentine hates the sight of blood. So it all kind of makes sense.
And I love how they're just like, all right, we know they're here, but one umbrella can apparently stop 50 guys from shooting at you.
Yeah.
But I also love how they say, all right, we got to take out Merlin, so just send a freaking RPG at him. Like a friggin' missile.
Well, that's the weird thing, right? The fact that all these heads are exploding, you think that's the conclusion. Oh no, we have more to go. He's not done yet.
No, they didn't stop anything because he triggers the signal, so everyone goes crazy.
Oh my god. And this mother going after this kid, my god. Again, the corrupted heart of Matthew Vaughn were worn fully on his sleeve here. Again, guys, this is the third time I've said this, but this is a fucking rough scene to watch this.
Yeah, with a kid cowering and crying, that's almost too much.
Yeah, it's 28 Days Later-esque.
Very much so.
Yeah, definitely. I also love you see people on the beach. I mean, look, at this time, if you went to Walmart on Black Friday, you could have seen this in person. Like, it wasn't really that far-fetched, all things considered. Eggsy has a fight with Gazelle, and they pay off the venom from earlier in the movie, which all the Bond movies did. That was the trope.
Completely from Russia with Love, right? You got the blade on the end of the shoe.
The shoe knife that's out of From Russia with Love.
But I like the payoff, though, and I like this fight. I think this fight is very fun. I think, again, Vaughn's filming it very nicely. I love her just kicking and him avoiding him, and all of this is very fun.
Yeah, it's a good fight scene, choreographed well. From the fact that her name's Gazelle, like the animal, because of how she runs, there's a funness to every wink, and I think it's fantastic.
Well, they also avoid what Kick-Ass struggled with of having... You couldn't have Kick-Ass fight the Mother Russia character, but because this movie is hyper-fantastical, you don't bat an eye at him fighting her.
No.
And not feel like it's sexist or anything. Because, you know, the Bond movies, outside of throwing a helicopter onto Famke Janssen and GoldenEye, Bond could never punch a woman or... I mean, he could slap them if you watched some of the first couple of Roger Moore ones.
Yeah, but, I was going to say, the first couple of Sean Connery movies, too.
Yeah.
Doesn't bat an eye at hitting a woman.
You couldn't have, like, this.
Yeah,
like, you're right. You had to have Halle Berry fight Rosamund Pike, et cetera, et cetera. But they get around it here. And Matthew Vaughn must love Mortal Kombat because he freaking takes one of her prosthetic legs and just throws it like a harpoon.
Loved it.
In Valentine's chest.
Loved it. And him,
it came from his own henchmen.
Yeah, came from his own henchmen. And again, he hates the sight of blood, so he's throwing up at the camera. Very much like Kick-Ass 2. We're seeing the vomit happen here as well. It's all just really goofy, crazy shit.
Well, it's also the bombastic ending that a movie of this tone and this caliber warrants. And like any Bond movie, it ends with him bedding the princess.
I love that they actually had to cut out a version, depending on which way you see it.
Oh, yeah, because if they kept that, all the misogynist, the comments would have been been a talk on the internet. But this is how he gets inducted. He takes over for Galahad. And the movie ends with him. Well, for the record, this is also what would have happened if Mario in the first game, if Princess Peach was in that castle.
Didn't make that connection.
At the end, if you pay attention, they're both here at the table. So Roxy and Eggsy both end up being Kingsmen.
Yeah, so everybody gets what they want. I mean, it's kind of it makes sense because he died, so they had to fill that spot. And I guess next man up, Merlin probably made an exception. My question is, okay, do you have to elect Arthur? Does someone have to literally pull a gun out of a stone?
But I'm almost surprised they did not do that the way that this movie does it.
Yeah, but the movie ends with a nice callback to the pub scene from earlier in the movie where Harry goes to confront the gang and his stepdad, dressed to the nines, locks the door, and credits roll. Nice wrap up here.
Yeah, considering that from the terrible place that he had come from, this is a complete circle, right? So yeah.
A golden circle, if you will.
Until next week.
Well, that does it, because there's no post-credit scene or anything like that. And in a crisp 2 hours, this movie...
This did have a couple, I thought. There was one after the initial credits and one after the final credits that I didn't stick around for, because I thought for sure you would get to it, but I guess not.
I didn't realize there were post-credit scenes. Adam, do you know about these?
Nope, not a bit.
I just found them. So one of the post-credit scenes is he tells his mom to go live in a new house. So I guess that one makes sense. That's fine. That's good closure. But yeah, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you give Kingsman the Secret Service? Let's go to Adam first.
It was 1. Sadly, as I mentioned before, with a bad joke, I apologize to anybody who may be offended. Get over it. But I avoided this in theaters, and I'm kind of still upset to myself that I did. But once I saw this on video, once I got it and watched it home, this is a kinetic, fun love letter to spy movies as a genre, to Bond movies as a whole, and done so in Matthew Vaughn's very distinctive voice. I think the casting across the board is extremely well done. While I think the character that Sammy Jackson plays is too old for it, I love him in this. Everybody in this, I think, is great. I just don't care for all the characters. I don't necessarily like all the group auditioning for Kingsman. It needs to be in this movie, but it feels a little ham-fisted. I can't stand the dude dating Eggsy's mom, and I'm not supposed to, but that just feels dirty every time it flashes back to that apartment and that household. This movie, though, is so damn fun. The nod by having Mark Hamill in it, it acknowledges and winks to the comic that it came from or was done in concert with, depending on how you want to look at it. This is such a starring role for Taron Egerton. Like, I'm so glad he blew up after this, because if this wasn't seen, I don't know that he would have, but I'm so glad that he did. Michael Caine is having fun. Mark Strong is just top notch at everything that he freaking does. The action, the attack on classes and what it means of who could come from someone literally down in the gutters to rise up to fight the rich class is buried in a movie that is fun, pompous in all the best ways. It's deeper than it realizes. It's enjoyable, whether you're watching it by yourself or with a group of people. It's hyper-violent. Its language is as blue as it gets. And once you realize that, which you realize about 3 minutes into the film, you can sit back and enjoy it. I love Kingsman. I think this thing is fantastic. I'm going to give it an 8. I got some issues with it, but I think a 7 is just too low. I'm done with giving half the scores. I'm going to give it an 8. I freaking love this movie. Anytime that it's on, I will stop and sit and watch it until I have to leave or until it finishes. So yeah, I'm going to give it an 8.
Stop the press. We have stopped giving okay scores or bad scores. Finally, something in this Marvel retrospective has gotten a pretty high score, but let's go to the other guy in this podcast because I feel like a 4 is coming. Only joking.
My first revisit of Kingsman after 10 years of being away from it, the result of it was a mostly fun, mostly well-cast film that is about as close to a love letter as Mark Millar and Matthew Vaughn could give to the spy genre. I think Colin Firth is really great against casting. Matt, you hit it for me. It's Liam Neeson in Taken, where you're seeing him in action for the first time, and you can tell that he put in the work. He's in great shape, and you believe him as a mentor to our main character, Taron Egerton, who I hadn't heard of before this, and I'm glad he's gone on, as Adam said, to bigger and greater things, because I cannot stress enough, you have to be with this character its entire run, and you go with him. But forewarning, I don't label myself a prude. I can stomach a lot of things, but if you have not seen this movie in the 10 plus years it's out, first of all, where the hell you been? Second of all, there is some rough things to get to the end of this film. It is a rocky road, man, and I say that mostly complimentary. I think there are times when Vaughn goes too far, but at the same time, you have to go that far to see how deranged and how wicked the main villain's plot is, which, Sam Jackson, I love you, dude, but as much as I love the villain's plot, I can't stand his casting. He just distracts me way too much. There's a lot of fun stuff here. If you love those old Bond movies, as the three of us, we reviewed them years ago, we all said some pretty good things about the majority of them. This is done mostly for you. I had a good time revisiting this. I find it far from a perfect film. There are some major issues that I mentioned as we went through this. I hate to do this, but I'm going to go with the same exact score I gave Kick-Ass, because I had just as good a time. I'm going with a 7. It's very enjoyable, but there are some pieces that I definitely would have done differently. That being said, I was sad I hadn't revisited it in the 10 years since, because this is a pretty fun ride. So 7 out of 10 for Kingsman Secret Service.
So as the Bond guy on this show, considerably more than the two of you, I had the biggest reservation, I would say, going in, because I didn't want another Austin Powers type of... Look, I like the first couple Austin Powers movies, but I didn't want like a full-blown spoof. I think this functions as both a parody in that sense, because it's played for yucks when it needs to, but I like the... Garrett, what you described as being a prune, I like those moments of just bitter realism, because without them, this would be a Saturday morning cartoon just with a lot of blood. And it would have, I think, it would have gone too far into that direction. It would have become Kick-Ass 2, where you stop being the thing that you set out to satirize. You became the supervillain. And speaking of the supervillain, I have so much fun watching Sam Jackson in this movie. And I can't believe I'm saying that, because it's not that I don't like him, but when I saw what he was dressed like, I was like, oh, this is ridiculous. I mean, we didn't even talk about the scene where he shows up getting the tailored suit. I think that's hysterical, because he wears it for that one scene. He's like, this is stupid. But as a star-making vehicle for Egerton, that's a tough line to cross. You know, you're casting an upstart for a character that's got a lot of complexity, and you have to be with him at all times. So I think they knocked it out of the park. Supporting cast across the board is top-notch. I don't have a lot of complaints, and unlike you, Garrett, I watch this maybe once a year on the regular, and it's up to this point. I mean, look, outside of Big Hero 6, this fucking retrospective has been a slog thus far with Marvel, but that's how we structured it. We knew it was going to be heavy lifting to start. This is a welcome relief, and by far and away my favorite movie that we've done up to this point. So based on enjoyment and just how much I watch it, I have to give this a 9. I don't have a lot of complaints. I really don't. Outside of just the quote-unquote laziness of his one phone call being the thing. That's really my only major like critique.
Wow. So that means you must have really looked forward to the sequel then, right?
Oh, I did. I was beyond excited for the sequel. Because it looked like they were doing... You got the training out of the way. So now you get to really explore the world. And they were doing like the American Kingsmen with, of course, their like Southern whiskey distillers. I thought that was a good contrast. And Julianne Moore being the villain certainly intrigued me, because that seemed, in the same way Colin Firth is kind of against type.
Oh, that's interesting.
Julianne Moore being, you know, the Bond villain is inspired because she's a phenomenal actress, but not who you would think of.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the trailers for that, I mean, they used Sinatra's My Way in the first trailer. What gave me concern was the ending of the trailer gives away that Colin Firth is in the movie. So I was like, okay, that kind of retroactively takes away from this movie in a certain way if he's indeed alive. But is it him in the fullest form? Garrett will find out next week. But Adam, since you didn't see this in the theater, what did you do with Golden Circle?
I couldn't wait. I was so happy that they were making a sequel because that means I got to go see it in the theater. And yeah, I thought the trailer was really well done. The cast made me extremely excited. I mean, Juliana Moore, I would today. Everything else, I love the idea that we were bringing in the Americanized version of it. I thought there was a lot of fun there. But yeah, I had the exact same anger, and I'll call it anger, when they revealed somehow we were going to get Colin Firth playing a character. Because if I remember right, I think that I think Vaughn was furious that that was put out in a trailer, if I remember right. I think he was just livid. So I was with him, because I think whatever you decided to do, however you were having him in this film, wasn't something you should have spoiled. But I was there in theaters. I was there opening weekend. I was by myself, but I was extremely excited for Golden Circle.
And Garrett, you had no interest, I assume.
You know, it's not that I had no interest. I just, maybe that is it. Maybe that is that I didn't have any interest. I thought this was a full, complete film. Well, mm-hmm. We'll talk about this when we get to Firestarter, but this felt very complete to me. I did not need a sequel to it. Maybe that is it. Maybe the fact that this was a sequel to a film I felt was full is the reason why I didn't go to it. But at the same time, 2017 was a tumultuous year for me personally, and going to movies at this time was not on top of my list. So Kingsman completely passed me over, and the movie after that, honestly, when we started this, I thought there were only two Kingsman movies. I had no idea there was a third. So yeah, this next 2 weeks will be two first-time watches for me.
Well, speaking of first-time watches, I should also mention that what scared me was Secret Service reminds me a lot of the first Men in Black. And I hate what they do in the Men in Black sequels. And that's the template I was worried they were going to follow with this. Because I saw bringing Colin Firth back as the same thing when they brought Tommy Lee Jones back in Men in Black 2. I'm like, that dynamic was so good and that character got closure. Why are you bringing him back when this should be Will Smith and his new partner, Linda, what's her name, from Dogma? This, I thought, okay, you're setting up Roxy and Eggsy to be a duo. Why are you bringing Colin Firth back? So I had a lot of questions, but I was still really pumped to go see it because I loved the first one and I thought the trailers for this were good. So until next week when we review Kingsman The Golden Circle, Manners Maketh Podcast. Thank you, boys. I'm gonna be risky.
I know what you're gonna say.
I should be proud of myself because I'm finally using my gift for something important.
No, I was just gonna tell you your flight was down for the whole show.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Congratulations. Bloody well done.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You're right about the snobs, but there too, there are exceptions.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Pretty fucking great.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How was that? Not so bad. Kind of fun, huh?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise,
the Lethal Weapon films, the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Okay, you cunts. Let's see what you can do now.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Words to live by. Exit. Words to live by.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
As long as your heart's in the right place, we don't care what you put in your mouth.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I feel like a tornado in a trailer park.
Scheduling done by Matt.
I'm trying to figure out how to explain this without sounding like a complete idiot right now.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Playtime's over, kid.
I never play.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
What the fuck are you doing here? You taking a piss?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
You really believe in all this?
I believe that when a man's chest becomes an insect's palace, when his eyes are gone and his limbs ain't there no more, when I'm so scared I want to handcuff myself to my bed to keep from coming to work, yeah, I believe it, man. I believe I don't want to die, Sheriff.
Show's over, motherfuckers.
Matt, have you ever had cats?
You're asking a gay man if he's ever had pussy.
All right.
Now, I've had dogs all my life.
Look, I love those movies because I love film, but you're not breaking a box office with the majority of those.
No, and... Well, first of all, to go to your XXX, I can't believe Vin Diesel, of all people, is talking about how spy films took themselves too seriously, considering what Fast and Furious turned into. By the time you get to number 6, they are secret agents for all intents and purposes. Hobbs is a spy for the context of that movie. So I will say I don't like XXX, but I have a soft spot for the second one because it's so aggressively terrible that you can't stop watching it. That's the one with Ice Cube.
That's the one of those I haven't seen yet.
This is also, Garrett, you mentioned James Bond. Well, and then the third person who I was shocked to see because I thought he was left on the deck of the Flying Dutchman after Davy Jones stabbed him. Because this is Norrington from the Pirates movies.
Oh.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Well, this is also when we're seeing Mark Hamill, right?
No, that's the next scene.
The next scene. Okay.
Because
right.
Because they do a time jump, so Harry goes to see...
This guy's a talent. He really, really is. I think this movie could write him a little better, but I think we spend too much time with some other characters. But he's likable right off the bat, even when he's being an ass, even when he's being precocious. And he's someone you want to follow. He has that it about him.
Yeah, I completely forgot he was in Rocket Man.
So the Academy.
Yeah. He actually did the singing.
Yeah, the year before they gave Rami Malek an Oscar for putting in fake teeth and lip syncing.
He's the gorilla in Sing. He does a fantastic job.
Yeah, and somewhere Elton John watched that movie and said, "Find me that gorilla." Which ironically does tie into the next movie. I'm not going to say how, but
yes,
there is a connection. But I also like that just because they're quote unquote kids doesn't mean that there's going to be any training wheels.
Oh, yeah.
Because their first, well, I'll save the first trial. Harry is...
You see, if Spike Lee had a child with Mark Zuckerberg, this is who it would grow up to be.
That's an image I don't want to think about.
No, I don't either. But you know what? Mark Zuckerberg. I think Jesse Eisenberg. And another thing it does that's really clever, too, is at one point, what is the Colin Firth character name?
Harry?
Yeah, at one point. Yeah, at one point, Harry's talking.
But it goes wrong because they get tied to train tracks, which I also love that because that is James Bond being tied down with the laser coming towards them.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Also going back to those old Silent Hill films. Silent Hill. Those old Silent films, right? Where people are tied to tracks and they have nowhere to go.
Oh, until next week when we review Kingsman, the Golden Chalice. What the fuck is this called?
Golden Circle.
Sorry, that's a.
Now I gotta watch Temple of Doom. God dang it!
Until next week when we review Kingsman, the Golden Circle. Manners Maketh Podcast. Thank you, boys.
Thank you. Okay, so take five?
Yep.
All right.
You be ready.
I mean, really, it should be a take two, considering the bullshit we're about to talk about.
Good try.